This is the Unconquered Podcast on Seminole Sports Radio, part of the VSporto Network, bringing you all Noles all the time.
In Florida State, we won national championships and ACC championships.
Back to some basics, consistency in what we're doing. Guys getting rolled banged and bruised, working a bunch of different situations, making progress.
You have to have success so you know something, I can really do this.
Welcome back to the Unconquered Podcast, everybody. This is Jason Staples, your host. And we're going to be talking today. We've got two segments. First, we're going to talk a little bit about Florida State basketball. Florida State on a five-game losing streak and renews Leonard Hamilton's contract, which obviously has a lot of fans up in arms. A lot of people out there who don't feel like that's necessarily the best decision at this point for the Florida State program, but we'll talk a little bit about that. And then after that, we're going to talk a little bit about Florida State recruiting 2017, basically where things stand at this point in the process. Where Florida State's boards are. Just going to do a quick and dirty on that one. So let's go ahead and get to segment one. We're talking about Florida State basketball. I was actually just at the Florida State Duke game last night. It's actually my first time covering a game at Cameron Indoor Stadium, which was actually a real treat because you know, regardless of what you think of Duke, Cameron is one of the great experiences, one of the great places in college sports. And it really lived up, even though the game was not all that good. It was not very competitive because Florida State didn't take care of business on their side to make it competitive. But the atmosphere, even in spite of that, is really terrific there. Fans are their students are right on the floor. It feels like, you know, everybody's right on top of you. That kind of old field house is precisely how more college basketball stadium should be. It's really too bad so many programs have gone away from it. It's remarkable that Duke has stuck with it that long. I mean, the thing is, they could definitely sell a lot more tickets and they could have more luxury seats for their big boosters and so on that they could make more money with. But I got to give them credit because they've stuck with the traditional field house. I hope they keep it that way. I hope they don't change a whole lot over the years because it really is a tremendous, tremendous kind of environment that you don't get in the larger arenas. I mean, this is one of the things that, you know, at UNC, for example, the Dean Dome there, it's much, much larger. You have, you know, five times the number of people that you're going to get in Cameron Indoor, but the atmosphere just is not nearly as good. And it's because, more or less, because of the stadium as much as anything, because the arena is not as well suited. It's, you know, it's not you're not vertical, that they don't have people right on the floor the same way. It just feels so much tighter, so much more of an intimate and if you're an opposing team, suffocating environment in those old field houses than what you get in those big new arenas. And it's really too bad that that more programs haven't stuck with that. That being said, it's going to be interesting to see what Florida State looks like given all the renovations to the Tuck that we're seeing here in the next couple of years. Everything that I've heard on that is that it's really going to be a tremendous upgrade that basically Florida State will have one of the better looking and better sort of set up environments in college basketball after having really a dump for the last 15-20 years. You know, the Tucker Center, the former TLCCC, Tallahassee Leon County Community Center, it's never been something that it's always been an anchor in recruiting. It's something that has held that program back. And this is something where you've got to give Stan Wilcox a lot of credit and the Florida State brass a lot of credit and identifying a lot of the reasons that Florida State's program has not been where it needed to be in basketball. And the biggest thing is that Florida State's facilities and just overall environment on that, the support that Florida State's put into basketball has not been comparable to other programs. When you're spending 11th or 12th most on basketball infrastructure and so on in the ACC, you shouldn't be surprised when you're not finishing above, say, 7th or 8th in the ACC in basketball most of the time. So and this brings us to the point of where things are with Leonard Hamilton and with this basketball team. I know this has been a very disappointing season for a lot of Florida State fans who, you know, this is the best pair, really the best recruiting class, not just the best pair of recruits. You know, you throw Terrence Mann and this whole class into that. This is the best freshman recruiting class that Florida State had brought in years. And, you know, there's a lot of hope that this team would be successful, would be able to compete at the top level of the ACC, compete with some of the big boys because of Beasley and Bacon and Mann and these guys coming in. And it just hasn't materialized. And this team has been as difficult to watch in many respects as any Florida State team. And they've there's been some struggles. I mean, early in the season, you could see that these guys seemed to like playing with one another. There seemed to be a good sense of who had what roles. And Xavier Raton-Mays, we talked about it in the program, that XRM had done a good job of taking a different role, that he was now the number three option on the team. And boy, all of that has really changed. I mean, you go back to the Miami game, the end of the Miami game, which was just a total disaster, and largely because Xavier Raton-Mays is not exactly, he doesn't seem to be really playing the role that would be best for this team, and doesn't seem to be on the same page with the coaching staff and some of his teammates on that. And in general, that this team has not, is one of the things that stuck out to me yesterday, is in an environment like that in Cameron Indoor, you want to see a team come in with tremendous intensity, with a lot of basically playing with an edge. You have to play with an edge. You have to feel like you're going, it's us against the world, and you have to come in and play that way in order to win in that kind of environment. And I just didn't see that from this team. And one of the things that, you know, over the years, Leonard Hamilton's basketball teams have not necessarily been fun to watch, particularly on offense. And we've talked about why in some respect, that they recognize that they couldn't go out and get the talent that the Dukes and the UNCs did. So they went and they got guys who could defend those guys and ugly up the game and so on, and play great defense and play intense and potentially cause enough problems for those teams that you're able to pull the upset once in a while and you're a good enough defensive team to win within your tier. And they've done that with success over the years for the most part, but it's not been a pretty product. And this year they had guys that really belong on the floor. I mean, it's one of those things. You look at the dunk in the first half that Malik Beasley had, and just you watch Bacon move around the court, although, you know, he still needs work on his shot. Those guys belong on the field or belong on the court. And here I am on a Florida State podcast, so it's natural to talk about the field, but they belong on the court with programs like Duke and UNC, and those guys are on that level. They could be starting at those programs as well. So, you know, Florida State has some guys that belong out there, but the edge that they've played with in the past in terms of defensively and all that is just not there. And I asked Hamilton a little bit about this after the game, and one of the things that he mentioned was the real problem with this team at this point, and the biggest problem they have defensively, is they just don't, given the Kofor injury and the Ojo injury, they don't have any rim protection, basically, on this team. And he feels like the difference in terms of being able to protect the rim and some of the problems that they've had rebounding-wise has been really the biggest factor in affecting their defensive mentality, and their ability to play the way with the defensive principles that they want to play with. He said, we've been forced to play a lot more zone this particularly the last few games than any team I've ever had, because we can't protect the rim and we've had some of these issues. And I think there's some truth to that. But again, this gets back to you've got a senior in Bojanowski who has not really progressed. He's still not a smart, not a physical player. Still plays, you know, like a pogo stick, just vertical. Doesn't establish a base. Doesn't present a real problem inside for teams. And, you know, you got a 7'4" guy in your lineup there. You should be 7'3" guy. You should be able to protect the rim better than they have, but they just haven't. And so that's one of the things that they're going to have to. Even with some of the guys coming in, Jonathan Isaac, you know, he's not a rim protector. They're going to need to be able to protect the rim better next year. We're going to have similar problems. But in any case, this is where the reason for the Wilcox contract, and again, Stan Wilcox contract extension for two more years rather than him basically being out in one more year. This, I've tried to explain this on Twitter, but this has been hard for, I think, for some people to understand, and I'm not sure exactly why. But this was a hedge. This contract is the Florida State Administration, Stan Wilcox and these guys. And listen, criticize Stan Wilcox on whatever you want, but the one thing the guy clearly understands, he's a former college basketball player. He was an associate AD at Duke for over a decade. The guy understands basketball and basketball infrastructure and what it takes to win in college basketball. And he understands where Florida State fits in the pecking order. So that, just keep that in mind as I'm talking about this. They understand that the first thing that Florida State needs to do in order to have some success in college basketball is improve the recruiting, which that started to happen. And the reason for that is that Florida State has begun to really push a lot of money towards facilities and some of the infrastructure that's necessary to be able to attract some of the players like your Beasleys and your Bacons and your Jonathan Isaacs and those guys. You've got to be able to have places that they want to go. You got to have a practice facility they want to practice in. You've got to have a home court environment that they actually want to play in. And that's really where they're putting their money right now. They're investing pretty heavily in a major renovation to the Donald Tucker Center in the next couple of years. Over the next 2 years, we're going to see a pretty huge improvement in Florida State's home facilities. That's huge. What they didn't want to do was get put into a position where now you're making a coaching change before those facilities upgrades are done. What coaches can you attract when your facilities are still substandard? You're going to have to sell through basically the renovation process, restart some of the relationships. You're going to have to do all of that before you actually have the things in place to be able to recruit at a higher level. Or you can go ahead and count on Hamilton continuing to capitalize on recruiting momentum, which is, you know, this program has more recruiting momentum than Florida State has had in two decades. They're going to have the most talent on the roster next year that they have since 1993. With, you know, presuming that both Bacon and Beasley don't go pro, and I don't think that both of them will. I think both may stay. And I think within the program, the expectation is one, if not both, will stay. And then you put those guys on the court with a guy like Jonathan Isaac, and suddenly you've got three guys that can contribute like that on the offensive end. So they continue to have recruiting momentum, and that's what this extension was really about, is trying to continue to build that maintain that recruiting momentum while they're upgrading all of the infrastructure. And so then what happens, listen, Hamilton's not going to be here. Really, I think this is probably these next 2-3 years. He's going to be gone in 2-3 years. He may not even see the end of this contract. And that's, we'll get to that in just a second. But either way, if he's here through the end of this contract, by the end of that, Florida State's had some top prospects on campus. They've had some guys get drafted. And all of a sudden, you're competing on more of a level playing field in terms of facilities and resources than what you had prior. You're basically on a much closer to level playing field with all of the rest of the programs in the ACC, which Florida State has been recruiting from behind on all of those things for years. All of a sudden, you can present facilities that are on par, and then you can go out and try to get a coach. Then you can go out and you can get a better coach because somebody wants to come in and compete. And this gets back to another thing. A lot of people are looking at this and saying, listen, why can't they just go out and get a coach now? It's an ACC job. It's a nice place to live. I mean, what coach wouldn't jump at a chance for an ACC job? I've tried to tell you all this in the past, but the Florida State job being an ACC job is a downside for a lot of coaches.
Just like going back to discussions that we've had of on this program of the best jobs in college football, people talk about, oh, it's an SEC job, it's better. No, fans and media might think that. But coaches look at that and they say, that's an SEC job, it's twice as hard. Why would I go to Ole Miss or Mississippi State where my upside, my ceiling is third best in my own division? I might 1 year be able to win that division and then I'm going to be back to third or fourth. Why would I do that? Why would I go there when I can go to a program that can attract comparable talent? Let's say a UNC football. I can go to UNC and get basically comparable talent to what I can get at, I don't know, let's just throw it out there, Mississippi State. And really, UNC traditionally has been able to out-recruit both Mississippi State and Ole Miss when they've had the infrastructure in place and they haven't had sanctions and all that. They're in the position to be able to recruit with those teams. And wait, who's UNC got in their division? They're not going up against Alabama. They're not going against Auburn. They don't have LSU, Texas A&M. They don't have to deal with all those programs that have a better recruiting footprint, better resources and all of that in their own division. Yeah, you're dealing with Miami. But outside of Miami, who else is there in your division that you really feel like you have a super disadvantage against in terms of recruiting and infrastructure and all of that? That's why that job for coaches around the country is regarded as a better job. That's why two coaches, both Butch Davis and Larry Fedora, have turned down the Tennessee job to take the UNC job because it's a better job in being in the ACC than being in the SEC for Tennessee. The same thing is true if Florida State was in the SEC basketball wise. The program would be a much more attractive job, just like Florida, because all you have to do is upgrade your talent a bit, and all of a sudden you're winning. You may win the conference, or you're second in the conference to Kentucky. I mean, the success that Florida had just happened to be at the right time in terms of Kentucky taking a downturn for a little while. But Kentucky's the top dog in that conference. But okay. You suddenly, if you're Avery Johnson and you take the Alabama job, that's a great job for him because you upgrade just a little bit and all of a sudden you're competing for the conference, as opposed to you upgrade that amount at a place like Florida State and you're hoping to finish fifth because the ACC is a much tougher conference. So that's something a lot of people forget when they're thinking about this, is that in order to be able to compete for an up-and-coming coach, let's say a mid-major coach or a name coach, it's actually harder to do in the ACC until you have the infrastructure to basically say, listen, we can compete with similar facilities, with similar resources as the top dogs in that conference. So basically, what they're trying to do is they're trying to make sure in this extension that they have some level of consistency in the program, even if that means that they only finish, let's say, fourth or a little bit below, somewhere in that mid-tier of the conference the next 3 years, fine. They've not lost momentum and gone to the basement like Wake Forest or Georgia Tech or those teams, or even NC State, which lost a ton of momentum at one point. They're not going to lose all of that momentum that they have in terms of being able to get talent on campus while they're building to be able to put the program in place to be able to compete at a little bit higher level. You try to reset what your ceiling is by improving your infrastructure and all of that. So that's what this is about. And the other thing is that this only being a two-year extension is also a put up or shut up kind of thing as well. They're going to be closer to having all of those things done next year than they are this year. In terms of infrastructure. And basically, if Leonard Hamilton can't win next year with the talent that he's got, well, then they can just basically say, okay, you've had your chance to show that you can take this program a little bit further by, you've gotten talent on campus, but you haven't done anything with it. Now we feel like we're in a better position to pursue a replacement. That's what you do. Now, it's too bad, obviously, that Andy Enfield is already at USC because he ain't leaving USC to come to Florida State. This is something that a couple of years ago before he took that job, I was one of those people who was saying, listen, bring Enfield back. He's the guy that, if you look at the guys that have improved in the Florida State program, they improved when Enfield was on the staff as an assistant. And then he went to Gulf Coast and, you know, really turned that program around. He's a really, really good coach. And that's the guy that, you know, I would have preferred a few years ago to take over. You know, you move on from Hamilton and let Enfield take over then. But he ain't coming. He ain't leaving Southern Cal for Tallahassee on that one. So, but that's the kind of guy you got to go get after you've set the infrastructure in place. That's really what they're trying to do. Bottom line is they're trying not to lose too much momentum while they're putting all of the things in place to be able to compete longer term, and to be able to hire someone a little bit higher end 1 or 2 years from now, and that, you know, maximum of 3 years from now, but probably 1 or 2 years from now. And to me, that I think is better strategy than I think a lot of fans appreciate. Am I really satisfied with the product that I see on the floor at this point from Florida State? No, I don't think anybody is. I don't think the Florida State brass, I don't think the people who extended Leonard Hamilton's contract are thrilled with what they're seeing on the floor right now. But they do understand, I think this athletics director and this athletic department understand what's necessary to be able to get to the place where the program can compete a little bit better with some of the other major programs in the conference. And let's be honest, Florida State's talent, as good as it is with Bacon and Beasley, particularly with Kofor out, they're not in the top half of the ACC. Even with Bacon and Beasley, they're not in the top half of the ACC in terms of talent. So you're not going to expect them to finish third or fourth or fifth in the conference because they don't have third or fourth or fifth level talent in the conference. But you do hope that you beat your team, you beat the teams in your own tier, and that's what you need to do. And since Kofor's injury in particular, they've a couple meltdowns again against Miami and the inexcusable Georgia Tech loss. You can't lose to the teams in your own tier. But at the end of the day, those are the teams in Florida State's tier. Florida State's not in the Duke tier. They're not in the Louisville tier. They're not in the Syracuse tier. That's just not where this program is. That's what they're trying to do. That's what they're trying, where they're trying to get in the near future in terms of upgrading the infrastructure. All right, we're going to go ahead and move into the next segment where we're looking at the quick and dirty of the Florida State recruiting boards, who Florida State is really targeting in this 2017 recruiting class. And again, this is going to be a smaller class, but we'll talk about where the sort of offensive and defensive boards fit, who Florida State's targeting, and what we can expect from this recruiting class. In general, I think the main thing to remember is that this is going to be a much smaller class. They don't have a whole lot of numbers. They're going to have 10 seniors on the roster this year. Once they've cleaned up a little bit after the spring, they're going to wind up narrowing down a little bit in terms of they've got 89 guys on roster right now. They'll have 85 going into the fall. And so, you know, at the end of the day, they're going to, they're only going to have, They're counting on, say, 17 or so, 16, 17 spots for next season, barring a couple additional transfers or injuries or whatever that lead to a couple extra spots being open. So that means they're going to take a much smaller class. And you know, we had initially been projecting about 20 spots, and we've been told that that's actually they're really expecting 17, maybe 16. In this class. So given that, and again, they would need three or four more unexpected guys to transfer, move on, or get hurt or whatnot in order to have what we were initially projecting. So that's say 17. Let's go with that number. They are going to bring in a quarterback if they can. Nikosi Perry is the top target there. Bailey Hockman is the next target. I think either one of those guys they'd be happy with. They'll probably get one of them. From what we understand, running back, they're going to have two options. They're going to bring in two. So that's three guys total. Right now they have Zaquandre White from North Fort Myers, who's committed, but there's a real good chance at this point. I think Kalon Laybourne is going to commit very soon, maybe at junior day. I think he's going to be in the class, the teammate of Levante Taylor, high school teammate of Levante Taylor. I think he's going to commit fairly soon, one of the top running backs in the country. And I think DeAndre Swift is a guy that very well may want in as well. So, I mean, you're looking at a good chance of bringing in two of the, say, top five running backs in the country, at which point it's possible that Zaquandre White may be told it's, you know, we love you, but sorry, we don't have room. But I think they bring in two running backs, you know, and I think it'll be two of the three, White, Swift, or Laybourne. I think that basically is what it boils down to. Wide receiver, you already got DJ Matthews on board. They're going to go for one more. They want one more wide receiver. We'll see who they wind up with. T. Higgins is at the top of the board as the next guy. They want a guy with a little bit more size, somebody that's, you know, 6'2 plus, if they can get it for that second one. If they can't get the right guy, they'll just bring in one guy, that being DJ Matthews. But they want two. So you go one quarterback, two running backs, two wide receivers. That's five. Five total spots right there. And again, T. Higgins is the top guy left on the board there. A couple other guys as well. I mean, they've had the top wide receiver in Louisiana just visited for junior day. But again, that's Louisiana. You count on those guys going to LSU. So we'll see what happens. But basically, expect five guys through those three spots. I don't know that they have room for a tight end. I at this point, it doesn't look like they're gonna have space for that. So let's say none there. Offensive line, pretty simple. They're going to try to flip both Calvin Ashley from Auburn and Alex Leatherwood, who has, you know, been basically an Alabama kid. They're going to try to get one of those guys. Leatherwood's probably the more likely guy between those. Both of those guys are offensive tackle prospects. But they want both of those guys if they can get them. And then they'll, on top of that, they'll take Tony Gray or Tadarrell Slayton, both of whom project as potential guards. Gray could be a tackle as well. He's kind of a swing. They'll take three guys on the offensive line as long as they're the right guys. And really, those are your four that they're going to try to pull three from if they can. They could potentially go dip one more to go down into that. But they're not going to take more than three, I think, this year because the numbers are so limited. And the guys that they're going to take are going to be top-level guys. So that means you've got about eight guys on the offensive side. Three offensive linemen, two wide receivers, two running backs, and a quarterback on the offensive side. And those are your top guys. And all of those guys are among the very best in the country at their positions. So again, this is a very high quality, but not a whole lot of quantity in the class. In terms of on defense, then, that means if you've got 17 spots and you've got eight on offense, that means you got nine guys left, nine spots left. They're gonna bring in two defensive ends. They need to bring in two defensive ends. Robert Beal, defensive end from Georgia, who was committed to Notre Dame, and then he wants to go to college at the same place as his sister. His sister was told that she would not qualify for Notre Dame. He withdrew his pledge from Notre Dame, and it looks like they're going to go elsewhere. And as of right now, we are projecting Robert Beal into the class. The Florida State staff feels like Beal is the best rush end in the country. Kid from Norcross, Georgia, would be a huge pull for Florida State. At this point, we think he's going to be one of the. I think he's going to be one of the top or one of the guys in this class, and I think he'll commit sooner rather than later. So I think Robert Beal is going to be one of the defensive ends, and then they're going to bring in. So he'll be the rush end guy most likely, and then they're going to bring one other guy in. And that other guy is going to be a guy with a little bit of size, whether that be a Joshua Kando, who is the talking to Wayne McGahee, the third from over at Noel Digest. He was talking about how at the Orlando camp, Kando was the Janarius Robinson of this year's class. He just looks like a grown man. But, you know, they'll go for Joshua Kando. They'll go for Marcavius Bryant, Malik Herring. One of those guys, maybe Jarius Parks or Chase Young, one of those guys will wind up as the other defensive end in the class. So that's two defensive ends. That puts you at 10 total commits, 10 total guys in the class. They're going to take two defensive tackles. If they can get a third, they're going to get him. It basically, they've got Jalen Parks and Corey Durden, two cousins who are teammates at Newberry High School, both of whom are Florida State legacies. Those guys are going to be in the class. They're both committed. very, very good defensive tackle prospects, each of them. But they'll take as many as three if they can add the right defensive tackle prospect. And right now, Marvin Wilson, the top defensive tackle prospect in the country from Texas, he's already been on campus once. It looks like he may visit a second time before too long. Very interested in Florida State. He's the kind of guy that you go after out of state. If he shows interest, you throw everything at him. You go ahead and try to get him. But if they can get him in the class, they'll take three defensive tackles. Another guy they're very interested in is Dalen Wade Perry, kid from Sparta, New Jersey, where Ryan Izzo played. Right now, he's a three-star in most services. If you watch his tape, he is not a three-star. He needs to be bumped up quite a bit, and the staff thinks very highly of him. If they can get Wilson or Wade Perry, they'll sit pat on three. That'll be three defensive tackles. They'll have three top-quality defensive tackles. Aubrey Solomon is the other name there, but I think they could take as many as three. They'll only take one more defensive tackle. Most likely it's either Wilson or Wade Perry that would be the third name on that list. That puts you at 13, right? Then you've got linebacker. They already have two linebackers committed, Vandarius Cowan and Bradley Jennings Jr. That puts you at 15. So at that point, you only have two spots remaining. If everything goes as planned at that point, up to this point, you got two spots remaining. You probably don't even have, you don't have room for another linebacker. Now, again, if you get a Markell Benton or a Dylan Moses that wants in the class, you make room for him. But other than that, that's where you stand. And then if you've got 15 at that point, if you've got 15 commits across those positions at that point, then you only have two spots left. But the thing is, they're going to bring in at least three defensive backs, and they really would prefer four. So that's going to be interesting to see how they work with the numbers. The defensive back board is as good as any I've ever seen coming into this point in the process. I think Stanford Samuels is going to be in the class, and then Malik Gray from Tennessee is going to be in the class. Stanford Samuels III is one of the best big corner prospects in the country. Would have been one of the best big corner prospects in the country last year. Definitely projects as a future starter on the outside for Florida State. Immediate addition. You add him, no problem. Malik Gray, I think, could be the best player overall in this class. Safety from Tennessee. You're talking about a kind of Derwin James type athlete. He's not Derwin James, but you're talking about a kind of versatile athlete that you can stick just about anywhere in the secondary. I think he's in this class. And then you got basically one more spot potentially to play with. Sean Wade would be the top of the board there in terms of who they would bring in. Deion Jones, corner from Archbishop Carroll in Washington, D.C., would be next on that list. And then Jamias Williams, who you know is from Lawrenceville, Georgia, just up the road, is another guy that they would have. Those would be the next three guys on that list. If you bring in three guys, you hope that it's Samuels, Gray, and Wade. And then if it's not Samuels, Gray, and Wade, then maybe Samuels, Gray, and Jones or somebody like that. But I'm not even sure at this point that they have room to take one of the other four-star defensive backs that would potentially want into the class, whether it be Daniel Wright or Cyrus Fagan, Trey Bishop, those guys. That's the rest of the board. These are top 130 prospects, 150 prospects in the country that you're turning away because you don't have space for them in your class. But given that, that's where this class projects. I think again, probably, you know, at some level, maybe they only bring in, say, two offensive linemen if the defensive back crop is so high. It's going to be interesting, and I think this is going to be one of those classes where it may be done a little bit earlier than some of the others have been, because they're going to need kids to commit and stick earlier just to know who's going to be in and who's going to be out and what numbers they actually have to offer. But it'll be interesting. I think, you know, they may wind up having to stretch to 18 and finding room on the roster somehow in order to squeeze the kind of talent that they're going to have in here. In terms of a per player basis, this is going to be potentially one of Florida State's best classes ever, on paper at least, in terms of the level of talent that they're bringing in across the board. So it's going to be an interesting thing to see. Again, I'm going to be this will be an interesting cycle to follow, just because of the numbers aspect that they haven't had to deal with quite to this extent in the past. All right, that's going to do it for us today. Now, before we get out of here, just a reminder, you can follow me on Twitter at Doc Staples. Of course, Seminole Sports Radio at Seminoles Radio for the latest on FSU sports. Make sure to catch the next podcast. We're going to talk a little bit more spring football, which is around the corner. Fourth quarter drills now about halfway over. Also, remember, you can also find this podcast on iTunes. You can subscribe through your podcast manager of choice. You can also listen on your mobile devices via the Seminole Sports Radio app, available on iTunes or the Android Marketplace. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Tell a friend. Help us a bunch. In any case, I'm Jason Staples. This has been the Unconquered Podcast on Seminole Sports Radio, a vSporto channel. Thanks for listening. I made this.